You know I've raved about outer before, and I love my outer sofa, outdoor dining table, and chairs. I've had them for over a year, and let me tell you, they've been through everything, from rainstorms to scorching sun, and still look brand new.
That's because Outer makes outdoor furniture that's actually designed for the outdoors. From using incredibly durable and sustainable materials to developing innovative solutions like the Outer Shell Cover, which protects my sofa and dining table against dust, debris, and dirt. No more soggy cushions or dusty tabletops. My outer setup is always clean, dry, and ready to be enjoyed anytime I want.
Head to liveouter.com/thefounderhour to see Outer's range of outdoor furniture, fire pits, and accessories. The Founder Hour listeners get an exclusive 10% off for a limited time. Terms and conditions apply.
So elevate your outdoor space with Outer. That's liveouter.com/thefounderhour. Hey everyone, before we get into the episode, just a quick reminder, if you enjoy what you hear, please follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. That way you get notified when new episodes drop. You can also follow us on Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn, at The Founder Hour. Let's get into it. Kurt Jones, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Thank you for being here. We were talking offline, and you said you grew up in Southern Illinois.
Well, first of all, when I say Southern Illinois, I grew up on a farm, and we could, some of our farmland was actually goes all the way down to the river, to the Ohio River, and we could see Kentucky from there. So that's how far south I was. And I grew up in a outside of a town called Grand Chain, Illinois, and there was used to be a chain of rocks across the river. That's where the name came from. In Pulaski County, which we always bragged that we were the second poorest county in the state next to the poorest county. So it was a real rural area. Mostly farmers. You know, we loved our sports. We played baseball and basketball growing up and hauled hay during the summers. And, you know, my granddad was, we actually lived with my granddad. My dad was an only child and his mother had passed away at, he was 17. So when he and my mom got married, they just lived on the farm with my granddad. And so I had two sisters and we all just grew up in the same house, and so always around like farming. But my grandfather was very entrepreneurial. He used to grow broom corn in the summer and process it, make brooms during the winter for extra money, and grew strawberries. And you know, my dad used to do things like work on the old tube type TVs and radios. So me and some of my friends used to piddle around with that kind of stuff, and it was just a great environment because you know we had scrap iron piles and. You know, you could just build things and play with things and experiment all the time. So it was that's just kind of the way I grew up.
A little different than city life, I imagine.
Yeah, a little bit different.
So growing up, what did you aspire to be? What did you aspire to do? Did you have any like passions that you thought might become your career eventually?
Well, I loved sports growing up. We used to listen to the St. Louis Cardinals on the radio every game, you know, and I'd be out in the yard, you know, acting like I'm hitting the ball and running around the house and sliding into bases. And so I loved baseball and playing basketball any chance I got. So really until I think I got up into college, which I enjoyed, you know, science and stuff like that. But I think I'd always just wanted to play sports or something. That's kind of what I thought about.
Were you good at baseball?
Yeah, I was okay. I mean, we had a pretty good team. We had like a 28-3 record my senior year, and we were a real small school. We had a good basketball team. I think when I got into junior college and tried to play a little bit, you know, which did okay, but I knew I wasn't going to be a you know professional ball right. player.
And did kids from your school or that area make it to the professional world at all? Or
occasionally we had you know one or two that got. I don't remember really anyone that made it like. That you would probably know or anything
right,
like that.
Right.
But I think when I went to, when I was in junior college, I was challenged a little bit by my chemistry professor because like the first year of inorganic chemistry, I didn't do well because I'd done well in high school. So I didn't think I'd have to study when I got there. And so he weeded out a lot of people very quickly and I was almost one of them. But then when I kind of started really concentrating on it, I got better at it. And then by organic chemistry, you know, I was doing better, and he kind of prodded me, like, well, what are you going to do? And I'm like, well, I don't know, you know. And he said, well, have you ever thought about pre-med? And I really had no interest in it, but I just said, yeah, you know, I guess I could do that, you know. And then when I transferred to the university, which was Southern Illinois University in Carbondale, a friend of mine, well, actually a friend of mine that I played baseball with and I just met because we were on like this summer team or whatever. He was kind of not a city kid, but didn't grow up on a farm, but he wanted to get into raising pigs because we raised pigs on the farm. He'd come down and help us during the summers. And so we kind of hatched this plan. He kind of came up with this idea that he wanted to raise pigs going to college. And so I'd done it all my life and figured, well, it's a way to make some extra money. So we rented a barn out in the middle of nowhere, and I put a trailer out there and lived. And anyway, long story short, I ended up spending a lot of time because we had like 30 sows having pigs, and I was missing classes. I think one week I missed like 8 classes, and, you know, so going pre-med, that didn't do too good whenever I got my grades the first semester. So I finally just decided that, you know, that's not really what I wanted to do, but I'd taken a microbiology course during that period, and I really liked microbiology. You know, it was I think having grown up on the farm, you saw all these cycles of life, and I had a really good professor. Dr. Madigan was the professor. And so I just kind of liked that from an industrial side, not a medical side. So kind of led me into several research projects and things like that.
Was entrepreneurship growing up where you grew up, was entrepreneurship something that you were exposed to? Like, was it something that perhaps you saw around you and wanted to also pursue at some point?
Well, I think growing up on a farm, in a way, the farmers are very entrepreneurial, and you learn very much about risk taking,
right,
every year, you know, because, you know, you basically go out and plant all these seeds, and in Southern Illinois, you can get all kind of things that can happen. You can get droughts, you can get floods, you can get, you know, so there's a lot of risk. I think you basically are risking everything. You kind of got to put in the next crop, and a lot of farmers too, they will find, like I said, other ways to make money during the off season, you know, starting little businesses and things like that. Like I was talking about my grandfather earlier, but maybe I grew up around it a little bit, mm-hmm. but maybe not on the scale that someone, you know, might be, like some of the people you probably interview, you know, probably were exposed to different things. But I think between growing up on a farm and then having the opportunity to do like research projects in college kind of led me down that path a little bit. Well, I did a couple things before I actually had my first, I say, real job. I worked in a prison for 3 years, so, and it was on kind of a research.
Like a sheriff, or
no? Actually, a guy I went to college with. We had done a project together in college that was. That's back whenever we were going to make fuel out of corn, you know, by making ethanol, and so we were working on this project, and then when he graduated, he actually got a job to put an ethanol plant into a local prison, which was a minimum security prison. It was going to be run by inmates. And then I got hired a year later to teach these inmates about chemistry and biology. And then the idea is that we would train them how to work into a plant environment so they could get a job, you know, down the road. But we had a lot of research projects, you know, kind of around that. And then I went to work for a company down in Kentucky called Alltech. It was called Alltech Biotechnology Center. And the guy that started that company was from Ireland. He was a really good salesperson, but also a good product developer. And I think that's where I really got this great training in entrepreneurship, because I would just watch how he would operate. And it's really like a lot of it's just, even like in sales, it's like listening and seeing what people need. But, you know, in his case, not only that, but he would figure out how we could make that product if it didn't exist already.
What was that experience like in the prison teaching some of those folks about things that perhaps they didn't know about before? Or I imagine they didn't know how to make ethanol.
They did. I actually learned from them on that one.
Oh, wow. Okay.
You know, it's funny. I actually used to run tests as the, they would get caught making, you know, hooch in the ceiling tiles. You know, they used to bring it to me to get what percentage alcohol so they could, you know, use it against them. But no, actually there were some very interesting characters, as you can imagine, but also some very sharp people, you know, that, well, first of all, you got a lot of time on your hands, and so you can study, and you can, if something interests them, you know, they can spend a lot of time on it. But I had one guy that could, because this was back in the 80s, you know, late 80s. And we had a Radio Shack TRS-80 computer that I used for, and I was actually writing my thesis on it and doing some things like that. One of the guys figured out how to write a screen dump back before you could just press a button and print what was on your screen. And it was quite a long, I mean, probably 50 pages of code, you know, that he had done. And I think the first time he printed the screen was like, you know, probably took an hour to print it. And then he kept working on it and got it down to where he could do it in 8 minutes. You know, I was pretty impressed by that, just, right, you know, doing it from scratch. And I had one guy that was a machinist. He could build anything we needed when we were experimenting with stuff. And, but no, it was an interesting experience. And they enjoyed, I think, what I brought in, because I was able to, I did a lot of my research on my thesis there. And so they actually helped me, you know, like run experiments in the lab and stuff like that. So it worked out pretty good.
What's cryogenic technology, and how did you come to become interested in this thing?
Well, cryogenic, I think the actual definition might be it's when you're dealing with temperatures like below 100, below zero. Right. So
like cryotherapy is.
Yeah.
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 Which, sub-zero.
So dry ice is like 109 below zero Fahrenheit. Liquid nitrogen is 320 below zero. And I think where I got involved in that was, first of all, when I was, like I said, when I worked at the prison, I was actually going to college, working on my master's degree at Southern Illinois University. And my thesis was on the production of lysine. And that's an amino acid that is, in animal feeds, especially in pig diets, it's the most limiting amino acid if you're feeding them a corn diet. So you add soybean meal to get a lot of the proteins that you need, and then lysine is the last one. You actually add an extra 100 pounds of soybean meal to get 3 pounds of lysine. And I found all this out from a feed salesman that came by our farm one day. And he said, you know, if you had 3 pounds, you know, he went through the whole story. And I said, well, where do you get it from? He said, it's all made in Japan by fermentation, bacterial fermentation. And, of course, I was in microbiology, you know, so that intrigued me. So I ended up doing my master's thesis on that. And I was going to put the first lysine plant in America. And I worked about 3 or 4 years on it. And I had gotten to about 75% of where the Japanese were at, according to what I could find in published, you know, literature and all that. I thought, well, by the time you have to ship everything overseas, you know, I might be able to compete. And the year I graduated, got my thesis, or got my master's, they announced a $25 million lysine plant coming into America, about 60 miles from where I grew up at. But anyway, having worked on that, it qualified me to get a job for this company called Alltech Biotechnology Center, because they were kind of into the alternative fuels things as well, selling yeast and enzymes, but they were getting into the animal feed business. Basically, they were doing all natural products, kind of probiotics, so putting lactobacillus bacteria into animal feeds. So I was growing these cultures, concentrating them down, freezing them and freeze drying them. And we were freezing them using basically dry ice in a way. We would actually float dry ice in an acetone mixture, put trays on it, freeze these cultures. But anyway, after a little while we started growing, I decided that I wanted to do it in a different way. Mm-hmm. And I started playing with liquid nitrogen.
So, you know, obviously that's a very entrepreneurial thing for you to do. And, you know, this is in college, I assume you were saying, in the college or master's program days.
Yeah.
So, you know, you talk about getting 75% of the way there, but what was it in your mind that even got you to begin something of that nature where you're going to be creating the first lysine plant in America? I mean, that's like a crazy thing. If somebody tells me now that I want to create the first X in America or name the country or region or whatever, I'd be like, why are you so special? Like, what makes you think you can actually do it? You know, I'm more curious really about your mindset in that moment, because I'm sure there's listeners thinking to themselves, like, maybe I have a creative edge somewhere, or I have, you know, an insight on something that better than somebody else, and I don't know if I should take the leap of faith.
Right. No. Yeah, I think it was just, I think I always just kind of was wanting to maybe have my own business. You know, I'd had a few little things, hay hauling businesses and, you know, that kind of stuff. And I like being able to work, because I was always kind of a late, like, I'd stay up late, you know, whether it was studying on something or working on something. So I always kind of wanted to be able to work my own hours. And I think I always felt like I probably needed to have my own business of some kind. But I wanted to have something that, well, like most people that want to get into something, they want to do something maybe somebody else hasn't done, or, right, or, you know, something unique or whatever. But
not to mention, yeah, like you're not constrained by like having to be somewhere 9 to 5 and like work, yeah, on stuff maybe that you're not interested in.
Right. And I think that just with the things I was studying, you know, like I was learning things that I didn't really know. Like I didn't know from the feed salesman that there was a little white powder you could put into animal, right, feeds. You know, I mean, just some, and I'm always curious, you know, like, right, well, I wonder where that came from, or I wonder where that came from, or I wonder if I could make that, you know, so.
You know, what's interesting about what you just said, meaning, you know, about this, the feed salesman, was that you were just kind of doing whatever you were doing, right? Like you were just doing your daily job, daily responsibility, whatever it was. And, you know, and I think, you know, Pat and I have talked about this a lot with different folks on the podcast and individually, that, you know, kind of diving deep into something or just being so involved in a certain area, certain field, certain job, whatever it may be, you're exposed to ideas perhaps that you would have never thought about, to, you know, to concepts that you'd have never known about, right? And there's the whole generalist versus specialist, but, you know, focusing on the specialist for a bit on for this topic, you would have probably never had that idea or started that project or been where you are today, but for being like, I'm just doing my job and talking to people, and oh shit, there's like this light bulb moment.
Oh, right? Yeah, no doubt. And well, Pat and I were talking earlier about Edison a little bit, you know, about the
actual light bulb.
Yeah.
He had actually worked a lot with carbon back when he was developing microphones and different things. And I was just telling, you know, we were just talking, but, you know, like the first time he ever recorded sound, he had, all that comes from all the other things that he had learned along the way and just had a special idea. So,
yeah. So you're at Alltech, you're like heads deep in this cryogenic technology that, you know, is that where this like idea for Dippin' Dots comes to you, or did that come later?
No, actually, so at Alltech, because we were growing these cultures, we ended up working 24 hours a day. I had to hire a bunch of people. We ran the fermenters at night, and we were really having trouble to keep up, which is the first reason I thought about liquid nitrogen is, number one, it's colder than what we were using. Mm-hmm. And I knew from my microbiology days that part of the process was you had to freeze the cultures, but then you had to freeze dry them to remove the moisture. And so, but you wanted small ice crystals to form because you didn't want the cells to get punctured, because these cells had to come back to life.
Right.
And so the faster you freeze something, the smaller the ice crystal. So that's, again, is why I started working with liquid nitrogen. When I first started freezing the cultures, there's different ways you can do that. You can pour liquid nitrogen into the culture and freeze it, or you can pour the cultures into the nitrogen. You know, you can do it both ways. But I found that if you dribbled it in, you can make little pellets. That was key because of the freeze drying process.
Was that just like a mistake?
Maybe a little bit, but not completely, because I guess
controlled mistake.
Yeah, sort of, because you know, you have to imagine we were freezing these slabs, if you will. And so just thinking about the freeze drying process, you know, if it had more surface area, so these little beads give it more surface area where it could pull the moisture out a little bit better. But then probably about a month into that, maybe 3 or 4 weeks, I used to make homemade ice cream on the farm all the time. Mm-hmm. And then my wife and my daughter, who was about 5 at that time, 4 or 5 years old, we would make it every other weekend or so. We had an old hand crank, and then we got like an electric crank and all that. But anyway, the point is, I was always making homemade ice cream. And so then I thought, well, you know, when you're making homemade ice cream, you want small ice crystals too.
This is a stupid question, but I've never thought of it before. What is the original ice cream flavor? Like when you're just like churning this, like the milk.
Like what does it taste like?
Yeah. What is it? Vanilla? It's not, clearly it's not vanilla.
Oh, is it tasteless? Is there actual taste in?
Because like, you're putting cream, right? It's cream and ice.
Oh yeah. Well, when you're making homemade ice cream, of course, you're basically using milk, cream, sugar, and vanilla.
Yeah. So vanilla is
vanilla's the base. Yeah. And then
I never thought about what the base flavor of ice.
It's interesting. I haven't either.
Yeah. But you know, you're using ice and you're using salt, and salt, you know, helps the ice, you know, gets a little bit colder and all that. So again, you're wanting to freeze it fast. And so that's where I got to thinking about putting the two together, because liquid nitrogen, you know, you're freezing something almost immediately.
But was it just for fun? Like you just, you're like, maybe these two will go together. Or did you like really see there being like a business opportunity out of this thing?
You know, it's funny. I've said this before, I've told this story before, but when I had the idea to do it, I didn't have the time to do it. Yeah. And it was about 3 weeks later before I actually did it. But I was already creating these marketing plans in my head.
So you didn't see, I didn't think of it as a business at the time.
I did.
Yeah.
And I felt like it's got to taste good because it's hard to make milk, cream, and sugar taste bad. Yeah. You know, so.
Here's another question, perhaps, you know, Kurt, as somebody who's obviously been in this business for a while, you may know the history of this. But like, I always think, you know, about certain things, like when, who created, like, who decided, let's like put like cream, or let's, first of all, get to the cream stage, right? Let's keep churning. Right. Like, I mean, someone's just like churning shit or butter. Like, you're like, they just keep churning. You're like, how, when do you wait? Like, I've never churned like shoes. Like, what will they turn into eventually? I don't know. But, and then combining that with ice and then being like, let's create some new thing. I mean,
a dessert out of that
or anything. Yeah. Like, do you know the history behind that?
Oh, I think it actually goes way back, like the Marco Polo kind of thing, you know? Yeah. Well, they used to get ice out of the hills, you know, and bring it down. And yeah. I don't remember the exact history. I read it before, but yeah, people used to, bring ice from the hills, and yeah, then they would mix it with milk and cream and stuff and make
that's crazy
basil ice cream. It's funny, in one of the ice cream books, they actually have this history all the way back, yeah, and they come up through, you know, where all these different, and then I actually made it into that book at one point, kind of like went from Marco Polo to Dippin' Dots. I thought, well, that's pretty cool.
So you combine these two things, this like technology that you are experimenting with at work with this thing that you're doing at home with your family and your kids, mm-hmm, and what comes next? Like you create this thing. What was the reaction? Like, did other people try it? Was it just you and your family? And what was the reaction you were getting?
Yeah. So at first, I had a good friend of mine that I grew up kind of on the farm with. You know, he was a little bit younger than me, but I was friends with him, and he had like seven other brothers, and so we used to do all kind of crazy things during the summer. But he actually, when we went to 24 hours a day growing these bacteria to do these products, I actually asked him to come down to work because I knew that we needed somebody that was a hard worker and that could stay during the nights and things like that. And so he was at a point in his life where he could do that. And I was telling him about some of this and about what I wanted to try, and actually took him out to the lab with me that first day that we did it. But I think it was on a Sunday. And of course, I had keys to the lab and everything. So we went out. I told him what I was going to do. And we had made ice cream that day. And I told my wife I was going to keep about a pint or a quart of it, you know, about a pint, I think it was, just to go out and make some, just to see what it would taste like. So I took him with me, and then we brought it back and let my wife taste it, and my daughter, and then also we had some neighbors across the street that we used to get together, and we'd make ice cream together and, you know, grill hamburgers and all that, and I took it over to them. And it was just really started out just friends and family,
yeah,
letting people taste it and watching their reaction. And I can always see they're, at first they're very skeptical, mm-hmm, and then you can
see
what
were they skeptical of? Like,
well, I mean, you never seen ice cream that way.
Right. Like, is this actually ice cream?
Right.
And, is there some sort of ingredient in this that's bad for me?
Well, and I, you know, we used to do a lot of practical jokes on our neighbors back then too. So it was kind of like, yeah, what am I eating? But then you'd see their eyes kind of light up a little bit. Huh. And then as you got to where you were experimenting, I mean, you know, testing maybe, you know, if you tested 15 or 20 people over time, you had very few negative comments. You might get maybe 1 out of 10, but everybody was kind of like, wow, this is really good, you know. And
Kurt, what year is this?
This would have been 1987, about probably April, May of 1987 when I first got the idea.
Yeah.
And how far did you, in your mind, when it became like, oh, this could be a business, like I could actually create these products and sell them, what was your vision for how that would be? Because obviously we know, and we'll talk about how you ended up being in like amusement parks and stadiums and all these places, and really like attracting maybe even like a younger crowd and a younger generation. But in the beginning, like how far did that vision go, and what were you imagining it would be?
When I went to work at Alltech, the guy that started that business was Pierce Lyons. He was a salesperson from Ireland that he ended up starting his own business because he actually went to make a sale one day, and his company wouldn't make what he wanted him to make the sale. And so he made it himself and made the sale, and then he started his own company. But I'd been working there about a year and a half, and really enjoyed. There was a lot of hard work, but I watched how he operated and did things. So I felt like anything was possible at that point. And I actually went to him and showed him the product and even offered, I think I offered him $5 for the nitrogen I used or whatever. And he kind of laughed, but he said, you know, it's a great idea. It's a cute idea. Great idea. He said, but get back to work, you know?
Yeah. But also this was something that was very different in a sense that it was like a direct to consumer product, right? Like it was a whole different marketing process, whole different sales process than perhaps what you were working on at Alltech, right?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. And, but I think, over the next 6 months, I couldn't get it out of my mind. And I knew in my own head that it could work, because I just watched too many people's reaction to it. And I loved ice cream too. So I knew that.
Like you had to do something with it.
Yeah. And a lot of people look at, oh, it works because it's a novelty. But I knew in my mind that it would only work once if it was a novelty. So I knew that it had to taste good. And scientifically, it's one of the best ways you can make ice cream, because you're getting these. And later in life, I actually took Dippin' Dots up to the University of Guelph, where there's a gentleman up there that does electron micrographs of ice crystals and ice cream and all this. And we actually had him test it, and he found that we got beautiful pictures. I'll have to show you, but the ice crystallization in Dippin' Dots is like 40 to 50 times smaller than in regular ice cream.
Why do you think no one had done it before? Was it just someone like you with the scientific background had to come along and also have a passion for ice cream?
Maybe.
And marry the two?
Maybe so. But I think, number one, having it in beads is a novelty, so that does help. But at the same time, from the science, yeah, you're right. But I think most people that were making ice cream up until then, like if you look at Häagen-Dazs, for example, the ice cream has large ice crystals, but they mask it by putting in a lot of butterfat. And on the other hand, if you look at Dairy Queen, they have a low butterfat, but they put a lot of air into it. So air and butterfat basically mask the ice crystals so that when you taste it, it still tastes very smooth. Mm. With Dippin' Dots, you don't have to add any extra air. You don't have to have really high amounts of butterfat because the crystallization is already small. So anyways, I mean, people don't care when they're eating it. I'm just telling you
I was going to say, I've never thought of the science of ice cream. It's kind of messing with me now.
I haven't either, but obviously when you try Dippin' Dots, you're like, I've never tried anything like this before. You can feel it on your tongue, like the way it's melting. You're like, this thing was just frozen 2 seconds ago, and now it's like, it's just super interesting. And I'm just curious, when you do start to sort of put the wheels in motion and sort of create a business out of this, how does your strategy for how you're going to get this out into the world come to you? Like, how did you decide, this is how we're going to brand it, it's going to be super fun and playful and maybe cater to younger people? I don't know if that was what you were trying to do, but kind of did, right? And so like, and then how are we going to distribute this thing? Are we going to go to the stores? Are we going to obviously go to these amusement parks and places that people congregate? And
well, I think at first, I was trying to think of a name that would encapsulate the product. And I had a lot of trouble doing that. And I had a lot of friends and family and stuff that would also, we had like four single space typewritten pages of names that I didn't really like any of them, you know.
What were some of the names you remember?
Oh, gosh. Grand Chain Rollers, Yoglets.
That sounds like an industrial
product. Yeah, exactly. Creamers, Creamies. I mean, I don't know. Just on and on and on.
Dippin' Dots is actually such a brilliant name.
Yeah, and the way that came about is we went home for Christmas that year. Because remember, this was like May or so when we were started playing with this. So we went home for Christmas, and we hadn't been home in a while because we were working a lot. And I told my wife and daughter on the way home, I said, we should have a get together where, you know, we could get the community building in the little town of Grand Chain, and we'll invite some people, and we'll actually have a meal like a potluck, but then we'll bring some beads in. And we did that, and probably had 40 or 50 people that wrote names down. And one of them, Vonda Jones was her name, no relation to me, but I had worked with her husband before, and he eventually came back and worked at Dippin' Dots. He actually helped build our first plant, did all the design work of that and everything. But anyway, his wife, Vonda, had written down Dip and Dot, like two characters. But when we were across the table and I heard the name, I heard it as Dipping without a G. Mm. To me, it just immediately hit, because I was trying to think of something that kind of described the products a little bit, but also that kids could say.
Yeah.
And I was kind of putting like my kid mind. Yeah,
the alliteration of the D&D is just like perfect.
So yeah, I knew whenever I heard it that that was the perfect name for him. So,
Tipping Dots.
Yeah. So yeah. So kind of the second part, I guess the question was like, how did you, so now you have the products. How do you go about distributing this thing? Malls and amusement parks and stadiums and all these places.
We knew that it was still very early in any of the branding or marketing. So we decided that we were going to open up a store. And we were kind of nudged by a guy that we did a little test marketing thing that fall and gave it out to people and got some responses. And one guy had left a business card. He ended up being kind of, I always refer to him as a shyster because he was putting in these little restaurants around Lexington and Louisville and Cincinnati area, and they were called Pasta Stops. And anyway, he was just this big talker, wheeler, dealer kind of guy, but he loved our products, and he was talking about putting our products in his restaurants. And then later he approached me and said, hey, I'm building a pasta stop in this new shopping center down in, on the northeast side of Lexington. And there's a space beside it. So you should just rent that space. I'll build it out for you. But if you know anything about Lexington, at that time, you didn't really want to be on the northeast side of town. Everything happened on the south side of town. So first of all, we were in a bad location.
Was there foot traffic at this location besides pasta stop?
No, there was, according to him, there were 20,000 cars a day that go by this place. And we found out later that's exactly what they do. They go by this place. No foot traffic at all. So here we are. We put all of our life savings into this store that I quit my job, you know. But the good news is that we had, we were there for about 9 or 10 months the first season and created like a lot of the flavors you still see today and all that. So we got a lot of work.
It was almost like a test kitchen.
Yeah, it really was. Luckily, we had a couple of news stations that came by and did a piece on us, and we got some people to come in from that.
How are you spreading the word around besides the word of mouth and people that you knew? Like how did people find out about it?
Well, at that time we had no money left for advertising by the time we went through this whole debacle of building the store out, and it took like 4 extra months to get it open. And he eventually skipped down. We had to track him down to, anyway, we had to finish the store ourselves. All this kind of stuff happened. But anyway,
not to mention the way these things have to be frozen, right? It's not common, I'm guessing, with other food businesses.
Oh, like, not at all.
Right. No. So you had to also build out this like new infrastructure. Was that a challenge? Like, how did you, because you have to find the right industrial like machinery and all these things to build out these like frozen.
Well, you're right.
Yeah.
I mean, in fact, the first machine that we built, we had to build it ourselves, you know, using machine shops and things like that. But we also had to get it approved at the city level and the state level, mm-hmm. which was quite a challenge because they were looking at it like, you're going to make it how, you know? And
right.
we couldn't even call it ice cream in the beginning because, well, at that time we were being regulated by the state of Kentucky. And they said, well, you can't call it ice cream because you're not stirring it while you're making it, which that's part of the ice cream definition. And so we had to call it like a frozen dessert. Later, when we moved to Illinois, we submitted our paperwork as a frozen dessert. And they said, well, you got to call this ice cream because it's got 10% butterfat. Mm. And we're like, oh, okay. Well, that's what we wanted to do in the first place, you know?
Yeah. Right. I guess it's okay in Illinois.
But yeah, exactly. But, you know, just a real learning curve for us in that first little.
Because you're like simultaneously building like this other business underneath it, which is like these like machines that you're freezing these things in, right? Which I right. know it sounds like this was a big undertaking. And you mentioned putting your life savings into it.
Which is only $10,000.
Which is $10,000. But if I were in that position, I'd be like, shit, this is going to be very expensive thing to do. Because we have to build these machines. We have to have these like locations. What is going on in your mind? You know, you mentioned having a little bit of press coverage, but did you really feel like this was going to be a long-term thing for you?
Well, I feel like it had to be for me. I mean, it's kind of like when you buy a franchise and you've got all your money invested, you got to make it work. Yeah. And so I always had that mindset. But I think what helped us eventually get over that hump was that winter after we had the store open for 9 months. I think we opened it like March the 18th and then, you know, come... Well, we didn't know that when kids went back to school, you know, nobody came in the store anymore. So our winter kind of came early. But basically, it's funny. My other family, my dad, my sisters, you know, they kind of wanted to get involved in the business. But now we lived 250 miles away from home. But my dad and sister kind of got involved, and we actually built out the old garage whenever we moved away into an ice cream plant, because they were going to make the product and bring it to Lexington, but also we were going to wholesale it to other places and try to get it out in some other restaurants and things like that.
This is like a residential garage.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We built it literally. I mean, we built it from sawmill lumber, and I mean, we built the thing, and then later when we moved away, it was just sitting there. So we turned it into an ice cream plant. You know, this is when we went back to Illinois.
Classic startup.
Yeah. But at one point, my sister, Connie, she actually, we decided, you know, we have to buy expensive equipment every time we put it in someplace because it had to be kept at 40 below zero. So we decided, well, we should go into places where there's a lot of people, like a theme park or a state fair. And so she started calling around, and she got a hold of Opryland USA, which was a theme park that's no longer there, but it was a country music theme park in Nashville, which was about 2 hours away from where we live, 2.5 hours away. And it was so funny when she tells the story, because she calls and they ask her all these questions. She doesn't have a good answer for anything they ask her, you know, like, well, how long have you been in business? Oh, just started. And no track record of sales. But anyway, we got an appointment and got to go down and present it to them that winter. And they actually said, yes, we want to put it in. So total failure the first couple of years because it's new and nobody knows what it is. But basically that got us into that market to where we eventually got to take that park over and run it ourselves, which means now we can talk to people. We have foot traffic finally.
And at the time, did you have those like square, like kiosks carts. Or carts? Yeah. Where you're storing these.
Not yet. The first location was a, basically we had taken a building and remodeled it that. And so that's why they let us come in and run it. If we would spend the money to remodel it, we could actually come in and run it and give them a percentage of sales. So it was the next year that we came up with the kiosk.
I think. Right. Like when you were at the amusement park, like you had, did you have it there or like, how were you serving the?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, actually I take that back. We actually wholesaled to them and it went into a, they built this new roller coaster called Chaos, an indoor roller coaster. And they put an ice cream stand right in the beginning of it, but nobody would buy it because they're getting ready to go on a roller coaster, you know,
right.
You're about to throw up.
So, yeah. So then,
dipping dots coming out.
So the second year they're like, oh, you know, our bad, you know. So that's when we came up with the kiosk concept, working with Opryland. They actually drew up a kiosk and we had that built. And so now we thought, well, this will work, but it didn't work because they would only open the kiosk on days when they had enough employees to do it. On a sunny day, all their employees sold, you know, Cokes and cotton candy and popcorn.
Right.
So the third year is whenever we got to take it over, they said, well, we've got a building. They'd already kicked us out, really, not because they didn't like us, it just hadn't been selling. And actually, a new food service supervisor came in, and one of the employees kind of went to bat for us and said, you know, these guys never really got a chance. So he said, well, why don't you come in, remodel this building, give us a percentage of sales. And then that's when we really got to go in and study how it really works. You know, you had to sample a lot in the beginning. We learned terms like per caps and, you know, additional spending and all these little things that are buzzwords that for a successful product, you have to. Mm-hmm. These things have to happen. So we were successful the first year that we actually took over and started generating some cash from that.
Kurt, were you relatively just calm and, you know, easygoing kind of guy, or were you just like this super amped up, like just always in hustle mode, just trying to, you know, figure shit out? Like, who were you like in that time? Because right now, like you're a calm guy. And so I can't imagine you were much different.
No, I was a calm hustler, I think.
Calm hustler. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, my wife knows that I can lose my temper occasionally, but it's very seldom. But no, I'm pretty low key. I try to stay pretty, you know, steady, but I never quit. I mean, it's like I can go back then, especially I could go 24 hours without sleeping if I needed to, if a project was going on. But I think I'm just one of those guys that's, like, I know I can get there. I know I'm going to have 100 obstacles before I get there. So right. I'm just expected.
What gave you that level of foresight at the time?
I don't know. You know, I mean, maybe I'm sure it's a combination of things of how I grew up some way, but I can't really put my finger.
Because I mean, at the time, there's no podcast. There's no really people that you look up to in terms of entrepreneurs. I mean, now you could, you know, in 1 second, you'll find all these types of motivational stories and quotes and this and that or whatever, like keep going, like, you know, you miss 100% of the shots you don't take, or whatever, all the bullshit stuff out there. But
I mean, that's like a pretty incredible mindset to have at that age. You know, you have a wife, a kid, like you have this business, barely any money, and like you think you're going to succeed, right? Like yeah. when the chances of failure are so high.
Yeah. I mean, maybe from, you know, Dr. Lyons, we called him, or Pierce, you know, the entrepreneurial boss that I had. I mean, I remember he used to say things like, well, in fact, whenever I left the company, you know, he bought me a briefcase and said good luck and, you know, call anytime I wanted to. But he would say things like this. Remember, he gave me two pieces of advice. He said, if you're going to be in the wholesale business, he said, you're going to have to cover your, you know, your overhead. And he said, basically, if you can sell a product that, if you can make a product for $1 and sell it for $2, that's kind of your margins you want to keep.
50%.
Yeah. Well, I mean, because that covers, yeah. you yeah. know, you got to, yeah. well, yeah, you got to buy equipment and you got to expand yeah. your plants and all, you know, so I always remember that. And he also said, remember that, you know, people buy from people. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of like, you know, forge those relationships and, you know,
I think people forget that a lot, like, especially yeah. in like tech with technology now, like, you know, the whole point is so that you don't buy from people and, right. you know, you speed up that process. Sure, there's tech salespeople, et cetera, yeah. but a lot of these good businesses that, like, you know, we Pat and Pat and I have talked about this, like, a lot of the businesses now that we see and we interview and we talk about and hear about, they've been around for 20, 30, 40 years. Mm-hmm. And the ones that have been around for 4 or 5 and then just kind of go away. Right, like there's something to these legacy businesses that they're doing right. Like,
yeah,
maybe it's low overhead and, you know, actually turn a profit.
Well, I mean, and just like I always think of Southwest Airlines, because I used to fly them a lot when, you know, but I know it's changed a little bit. You know, people don't necessarily buy from people, but at the same time, I think the companies that have these long term successful, you know, stories, a lot of times it's they treat people right at the end of the day. Right. You know, but I think that, and then. My sister Connie, who did, she had her, she had an MBA, so she had a little bit of a business, you know, education, if you will. But we used to have these, anything that could go wrong, you know, went wrong. But she was always kind of like, well, it doesn't really matter. We can't think about that. You know, we got to get up and go the next day. So just, I don't know, just a combination of things. You know, yeah. I think just growing up on a farm, like I said earlier, you see things happen, and it's like. Well, you know the old saying, you don't cry over spilled milk. You know, you just got to get up and keep going. And that was just always kind of our mindset, I think.
So early on, you talk about, speaking of overhead, did you have any like financial constraints when you're trying to grow this business, whether it's the actual raw materials for the products, whether it's, you know, the machines, all that kind of stuff? And if you did, how did you overcome them? Did you have to raise money from investors, or did you sort of just self-sustain through just selling?
We were always struggling financially, it seemed like, because but yes, in the earliest of days, we kept thinking about, well, maybe we need to raise some money, or, you know, and I was actually spending a lot of time, you know, trying to write a business plan or trying to do all the things you have to do to go and try to raise money, but just never was really successful, or when someone wanted to put money in it, they wanted so much of the business that it just wasn't worth it. And so you're like, gosh, you know, I waste all this time, you know, trying to get money when I could be over here selling something, right. you know. And so eventually we just had to sell our way out, I think, and keep our overhead as low as we could. Because the one thing I did have, we did move our business kind of back from Lexington to kind of the area where we grew up in. But a lot of people there who like my dad, my sisters, my mom, you know, but also like my wife's family, you know, my father-in-law and her sisters. And, I mean, we had a lot of people that worked, that weren't really getting paid what they probably should have gotten paid. You know, they were
like a family business.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, people believed in it though. So they're, you know, and you know, we would hire some people back then, believe it or not, for, you know, minimum wage was probably $5 an hour, you know. But then some of those people end up making, you know, really nice salaries for many years, you know, but it was just kind of, you had that kind of environment where people could see what was going on and what was happening, and they were willing to put in that extra work and stuff.
So obviously with something that is brand new, never been done before, and first time it's being introduced to the world, we hear a lot about patents and trademarks and protecting yourself. What have you learned about that? Talk to us about how you approach that piece. Because I know that it comes to play down the line when, you know, another something that happens often when something new gets introduced and takes off, you obviously see a lot of Me Toos and a lot of, you know, new entrants that are copying you essentially. Talk to us a little bit about that.
Yeah, for sure. So when I had this first experience growing, or, you know, opening this store, and I told you the guy kind of skipped down with our money and all, I actually, well, before that had happened, I did look up in the Yellow Pages in Lexington, and I found a patent office, attorney's office, and I was talking to them about doing potentially a patent. And then when all this happened, they introduced me to another lawyer in the firm because we had to do some legal stuff to get it, you know. But anyway, I ended up working with that firm quite a bit. They basically were patents and trademarks. And so we did apply for a patent. I didn't know if I really could patent it, but I took all the information I had, and they said, not only can you, really the first meeting was, can I do this? Am I infringing anyone else's patent? And they did a little bit of work, and they said, no, in fact, you probably can get a patent. And that's kind of how that all started. We opened in 88, like March 18th, but we applied for a patent on like March 6th of 1989. You have to do it within a year. We had the option of doing international patenting once you applied for the first one, but we couldn't really afford to do that, which came back to haunt us later. But it took from about 1989 to 1992 to actually get the patent. And then we, I think we got in like June of 1992.
Mm-hmm. Did you feel as though that protected you when you think of competition, there's like direct competition, like someone who's doing the exact same thing. And then there's competition within the industry, like other, well, whether it's ice creams or even other like desserts or confections, things like that.
Yeah.
Did you really feel like that helped you in terms of staying competitive? Like, how did you like think of competition in general?
I think I always knew in the back of my mind that we would be challenged, or, you know, if something would happen. Nothing's ever simple. And I guess I just been through enough to know that it's nice to have the patent, but I didn't really know if it would be like the end all be all of, you know, we'll never have any trouble again. So we get the patent in 1992. I think in 1994, we find out that there's somebody in Atlanta trying to get into an event, one of our dealers, because we didn't have franchisees back then. And the event actually calls me and they said, you know, what is Dippin' Dots? Well, it's like little beads of ice cream. They're like, well, we got a guy here trying to get in there. And anyway, we started this whole conversation. He said, but we've already got someone else doing beaded ice cream here or wanting to do it. And we're like, really? Who's that? You know, and that was whenever fax machines had just kind of, you know, we were doing everything by fax. And they literally sent me a fax that was our brochure, word for word, that had basically our name marked. I mean, you know, they had.
Yeah, like white out and then
scan it. and we're like, well, no, this is actually us, and somebody's trying to infringe us. And so that was our first taste. And we got them shut down pretty quickly because it was so blatant.
Yeah.
And then, of course, it was about a year later we had gotten, and I didn't even know this until much later, but we had apparently had gotten a letter from someone they were from England, but they had seen our product in Dallas, and they actually complimented us on everything and said they'd really like to work with us someday, but they were still in England or whatever. But then they called about a year later, and they wanted us to ship product to England, or they wanted to get into business. And one of whoever answered the phone was like, well, that's fine. You know, just you got to fill out some paperwork so we kind of know who we're working with. And they would never really do that. And then they just start kind of making threats, like, well, if you don't ship me some product, we're just going to make our own. And, of course, this eventually did lead to, you know, our first real, well, eventually competitor. But, of course, we had this whole thing that went on for a few years.
Right. And you mentioned franchising, which I think came around like 2000. Why did you decide to franchise, and how was it going to work? Like, were all these kiosks going to be, like, operated by franchisees, and how was that going to work?
Well, what was really happening, this was in response to, we had a dealership network, which, like I said, so like, let's say you lived in, Pittsburgh, and you wanted to put a kiosk in your mall or do events in the area, you would become a dealer, which didn't really cost anything, like $300 to fill out some paperwork, I mean, to get the legal work done or whatever.
And did you have certain criteria, like, did they have to be experienced in that kind of market, or was it just anyone that said, hey, I just want to be a dealer of Dippin' Dots?
Well, we tried to vet them the best we could. We would actually have them come to Paducah and see our facility, and we'd get to meet them, and some of our employees, we'd get to talk to them. And so it was pretty easy to become a dealer, but you had to show that you were serious about it. So we had about 113 dealers, I think, at whenever, you know, we had, when we actually converted to franchise, but all this was a year or two leading up to that. But one of the reasons we decided to do it was because the dealers themselves were wanting something that had more value to it, because we had always done just 1 year renewable contract. So if everything's going good, we just renew the contract and we're both happy. But some of them wanted to, they did, well, again, if you only have a 1 year contract, you don't feel like you've got much equity in your business. Mm-hmm. And so we started looking at, well, how can we do this? And so franchising was one of the options that we did. And so we were able to do like 5 year agreements with 5 year renewals. And so we thought it was going to be better for everyone. And we designed this transitional period. You could sign up to be a Dippin' Dots franchisee. There would be no franchise fee. And your product was actually going to go down in price a little bit, but you were going to now pay a 4% royalty, which is not bad, but it's a 4% royalty on your retail sales plus a 0.5% for advertising. And we had 105 dealers that signed up in a relatively short period of time, but there was 8 that didn't, and we never could. It was, we weren't really worried about it, just, well, why aren't they signing up, you know? So, yeah. But what had happened is there was a ringleader out of New York that he was selling product at the Yankee Stadium, and he was, and technically the franchise agreement didn't cover those types of places. It was more like malls and events. But we were going to address all that with a different type of an agreement. But we just hadn't got around to doing it yet. So they got this fear going that, you know, we were going to take over everything.
Right.
And so they held out. And by this time, we were in a lawsuit with the guy that had literally infringed our patent step by step. And we had gotten an injunction against him. And he didn't do anything for 3 years, but he went overseas, because you remember I said I couldn't really get the patent overseas, so he was going overseas and doing things. And but whenever this happened with the franchising, they basically, behind our back, approached this guy about making product. And so he became the supplier. And the reason he was able to do that, there was three different judges during this whole patent process. The first judge, gave us an injunction against him. And then he retired, and another guy came in, and they were going through the process. They brought in a special master. They started defining patent terms, kind of getting ready to go to trial. They brought in expert witnesses and everything, and a long story short is that they had this ridiculous ruling that if you had two cups of beads of ice cream on a counter, and you added little chunks of ice cream to one cup, it no longer infringed the first one.
Wow. So that would be categorized as something different.
Yeah. So this all happened about the time that the eighth that didn't convert decided, well, let's just get someone else to make our product and we'll just start a whole new company.
And they'll just add ice cream to it.
Or yeah.
Something else.
Yeah. Basically, where we were beads of ice cream, they were beads and chunks, which then set off a whole new series of lawsuits that became a third judge involved. It became multi-state, you know.
Right. Because you have to go through that, because if you don't, then all these copycats are going to come out, and now it's just going to be a price war, and all these places that you're trying to distribute to are just going to be like, well, who's the cheapest on the block? Because it's the same exact product, right? It's going to be like commoditized.
So even though we were doing well at the time, we were growing and expanding, we were building, you know, we were building new plants, we were building new, we were spending a lot of money, but we were also now spending money on the most expensive lawyer that there is, which is a patent attorney, you know.
Kurt, did this ever, like during this process of litigation, which I assume is very burdensome, did you ever just get turned off to the entire business at any point because of it?
Well, your focus becomes totally different than, you know, you got this fun product that you're expanding marketing. And marketing and having a great time with. I mean, there's business challenges every day, but then now you throw this on top of it. It was very difficult.
Yeah.
You know, period of time.
Yeah. How long did it last?
Well, I mean, all in all, it was almost, I think probably 8 or 9 years as well.
Wow.
Yeah.
So what happens ultimately, I think around 2011, the business had to go through Chapter 11. Mm-hmm. what happens, and I guess what did you take away from that experience?
Yeah, several things happened leading up to that, and one of them was the lawsuit. I mean, because actually the trouble for us started in 2007, and this was right before the big recession of 2008 and also the banking crisis that came after that. But we'd already been injured a little bit because we spent, all in all, we spent almost $10 million on this lawsuit. And at that time, we were probably like a 40, I'm talking in general numbers, but let's say we were a $38 to $40 million company. We had about $10 million worth of debt. Well, maybe 11 or something like that. But point is, almost all of our debt was related to how much we'd spent on the lawsuit.
Yeah.
Otherwise, we would have gone into the recession, almost a debt-free company. So you go into the recession, you're in debt. You know, all of a sudden, just the bottom drops out. You know, like, I mean, by 2008, I mean, I'd say probably 100 Dippin' Dot stores were probably closing because, you know, sales had dropped 40 or 50%.
And when you say stores, you mean like actual retail locations?
Like in malls and things like that.
Yeah, in the malls, yeah.
Was it almost immediately?
Almost, yeah.
So it's kind of like, you know, comparing a little bit to the pandemic, but...
Yeah, a little bit. Well, what had happened, I won't say it was immediate, but within a year because...
Yeah, I mean, yeah, pretty quickly.
Well, 2007, we did something like $47 million in sales just on our wholesale company. And our, of course, our we had a franchise company too, but we had profited, you know, a couple million dollars or whatever it was. But you go a year later, we did the same amount of sales, which was unusual for us because we were always growing. But we actually lost money because, you know, fuel prices had started going up.
Right.
Milk prices went up 34%.
Well, yeah.
You know, so liquid nitrogen went up 10%. So, you know, all these things were starting to happen before the recession actually hit. And then, of course, when that hit, and then the bank. And, oh, there's a lot there. I could do a whole podcast on this. But one other thing I'll point out is that the bank that we were actually working with at the time, they were actually one of the banks that were struggling. We didn't know any of this at the time.
They collapsed?
Well, they almost did. they almost did, but. I wish they would have actually. I mean, we would have been better off,
right?
But what happened was we had a line of credit every year. It was a $6 million line of credit. We would buy all these ingredients in early in the year, and we'd, you know, make all this ice cream. Then we'd sell it, and then in the late summer, early fall, we would pay all this back down to zero and do it again the next year. Well, someone that worked for our company and our accounting department basically had said to our local banker, you know, we're having a tough year, you know, so it's going to be a little difficult. And he's like, oh, don't worry about it. You know, we'll just extend it by 3 months. We'll restructure some things. We know you guys just put a couple million dollars into your plant. We'll recollateralize stuff. Well, we knew none of the stuff going on behind the scenes that this bank.
Just making bullshit promises.
Well, they were involved in some of the properties in the Southeast that had gotten upside down. So they were basically needing cash.
Right.
So the day that our credit line was due, after they extended it 3 months, we had been talking to them, but we'd never signed anything about extending it again. And they literally like said, well, now that you didn't pay your credit line down to zero, so now all of your loans are in default. And we thought, oh, wow, we don't know what's going on, but we'll just move it to another bank. Well, that's when the banking crisis started. Right. So, you know, one thing led to another. So it was just kind of a difficult time.
Well, I'm glad you shared the story because I feel like a lot of times, you know, you hear the pretty side of entrepreneurship and running a business, and you don't hear about the details that you just gave about the really, really tough days, whether it's litigation or, you know, financial crisis that, you know, one of those, I guess you could foresee a little bit, the other one out of your hands.
Yeah.
So. It ain't easy.
No, it's not
easy. Yeah, it's not easy.
And what happened at that point? Like, what did you feel like you would be able to do? Like, did you see a light at the end of the tunnel? Did you feel like you could take the business out of this predicament? Or,
well, that's the saddest part of the story because I never really lost faith. I mean, I knew Dippin' Dots was such a strong brand and had such a strong following. And I mean, yeah, we were going through tough times in the country, and unfortunately, the banks got bailed out. But they didn't pass it down.
Right.
Yeah. They literally just propped up their own balance sheets.
Collateral damage for everybody else.
And it even became harder to get money.
Right.
So anyway, you know, what happened for us is that we just stubbornly stuck in there and ran our business with no bank, essentially. They actually raised our interest rates to 24% on some of our loans.
Oh my God.
You know, and we just
like four times where it's at now.
Yeah. I don't know any business that could survive that.
Well, I mean, and the thing of it is, we almost did survive it. In fact, it was, as you said, it was 2011 before things really happened. But the sad part about that is that in 2011, we felt like we'd almost weathered the storm. And I literally said, I want to go up and meet with this bank, because we, you always say banks, you know, you go in and you open an account, you've got the salespeople.
Right.
But then when you get on the other side of the bank, they're called special assets people.
Right.
You know, watch some of the old mob movies. That's kind of what you're dealing with, you know.
Yeah. Those groups are coming back today, the special assets guys.
Yeah. And the bad part about it is that if they would have just been up front with us about what they were trying to do, we could have probably moved to another bank at that right. time. If they just said, hey, we need cash because we kind of screwed up, we could have probably moved our to another bank. But instead, you get a call from this guy that just starts threatening you.
Banker?
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, I hung up on him, and then, you know, just became a war at that point. But anyway, you know, if you go back up, we had almost survived this storm, if you will. And I literally asked to meet with the bank to try and work out a deal, because I felt like I thought we could kind of make our way through it now. And we drove all the way to St. Louis. I had an attorney and a couple of accounting people with me from my side. And we talked for a little while, and then it just kind of became negative. And they said, well, we're not going to work anything out. In fact, we've already put the paperwork together to foreclose on you. This was on like a Friday afternoon. And so Monday we'll be in to take over your business, basically. So we had to decide overnight how to, you know, fight that, which was a Chapter 11, which we hadn't really, I'd never been through anything like that. You know, right. And I didn't want to go through it. I always felt like I'll always pay my bills if you'll give me a chance. You know, if I get in a bind, just give me a chance. Let's work something out. And but anyway, we went into that process just kind of as an overnight decision based on that meeting.
And so as part of that process, Dippin' Dots got acquired, right?
Yeah. I mean, we really should have just went through the Chapter 11. I just didn't know enough about it. And I was almost embarrassed too. Of course, this was before all that stuff. Well, it wasn't before, but I mean, it was just kind of like, I'd just never been through that. So if I would have went through the process, we would have probably ended up fine. We would have probably just got restructured with help from the courts. But instead, I was contacted probably like within 3 or 4 days of filing. Of course, it made it into all the newspapers, Wall Street Journal. And, you know, we were contacted by a group out of Oklahoma that owned an oil business. It was, you know, kind of a father-son kind of thing. And they kind of approached it like, oh, hey, we've been through this kind of stuff before. Would you like to have a partner, you know? And so we thought, well, gosh, that'd be a quick, clean way to clean all this up. And yeah, we'll give up the business, you know, some of the business, but.
Was the idea like you'll continue to run it, but yeah, we'll like finance it and kind of just be silent?
That's the way it all started. Yeah. But over the next 6 months, it was clearly a more of a takeover kind of deal. And like I said, that could be a whole podcast, and I don't want to, and I'm not a negative person. I'm ready to just move on to new things. But
it's important to talk about, because as Posh mentioned, like, you know, these are the sort of the things that you never imagine or want to go through as an entrepreneur. Cause you have this, like this, you want to build something new for the world and see people be better off by it and yeah, kind of just focus on that. And then all this crap happens that you're like, can't really control, and you're just like having to, like you said, never been through it. I'm imagining most people haven't. Hopefully they don't go through it, but right, you know, they're in this position, like what do you do? Like you just have to figure it out. And for you, like I guess what was the biggest takeaway that you can share with us from that period?
Well, and I think you hit on something earlier. I mean, nowadays people can listen to podcasts and they, you know, they have a lot more information, so I think they're better equipped to, you know, to know what to do in these situations. But I think for me the biggest takeaway is that I've been asked before, well, would you do anything different if you knew this or you knew that? And I'm like, you know, I probably wouldn't, because I am who I am, you know? And I think in every situation, every time there's been a fork in the road, I've had to go with, you know, taking all the data that I've got at the time and make the best decision that I can. And I always felt like I made the right decisions.
At that time.
And I felt like, you know, we could have had a good partnership, but it didn't work out that way. I mean, it was more like a, you know, more of a, they owned the business, and of course the business, they stole the business later for, you know, $222 million, which it is what it is, you know. But the good news is they did keep all the employees that we had had. And most of these employees come from the Southern Illinois, Western Kentucky area, which, like I said before, we grew up in the second poorest county in the state. So, you know, all those jobs were kept. I mean, Dippin' Dots survived. The good news is that they didn't change our business model a lot. You know, what we were doing was working. We obviously had a strong brand. Some of the people that were circling to try to buy the thing, like before we actually went into Chapter 11, we were getting these, I'm sorry, I call them bottom feeders, but they're wanting to buy it, you know, for nothing. And, but they wanted to do different things with the products. And luckily, at least the people that did come in, they kind of kept the business model. They kept pretty much all of our employees. And, so the good news is the brand survived.
Right.
And so I think me and my family will always have that. Mm-hmm. That legacy of, you know, we created. And
Was it at all a financial success for you or not really?
Well, I mean, obviously for the 25 years or so I had it, we made a good living. Yeah. And there was, no, I did not get much whenever I lost it. Now, you never know what might happen. I mean, the new people that own it, you know, they've expressed some desire about working together again and doing some things and, you know, those kinds of things. But no, I mean, you know, it is what it is, you know, yeah. My family has done, over the years, we probably made a better living having Dippin' Dots than just having a regular job somewhere. Right, it's just, you know, you work a long time and you want to sell it someday or
yeah,
whatever.
You talk about being a positive guy. I mean, in that moment, in that time, I mean, you're what, at that point, you're in your mid 40s or?
Yeah, probably around 50, I guess.
So what's your, you know, mindset at the point? Obviously, you know, it's not the best outcome for you or Dippin' Dots, you know, in that moment in time. Do you still maintain that positivity? I mean, do you say to yourself, okay, it is what it is, on to the next, or do you just kind of take some time to just kind of soak it all in and
what
happened?
I'm on to the next thing. I mean, I mentioned earlier that my daughter was 5, I think, when we started Dippin' Dots. And so she and I actually started another company called 40 Below, which, you know, we have they're little beads of coffee.
Okay.
And then we expanded that into, we have different things. We have like a margarita, strawberry daiquiri, pina colada line called Island Rocks. And I developed a new product called the Fruity Whey, which is actually made from cheese whey, the actual liquid whey mixed with fruit. So it's got dissolved minerals and proteins and vitamins. So we're always kind of, you know, playing around with new things.
Mm. Talk about the difference now building these brands and the landscape and how it's changed from back when, you know, you first introduced Dippin' Dots. I'm sure it's changed a lot. And it seems like now every day there's like all these new products coming out and it's just gotten, for lack of a better word, like noisier and noisier than ever in terms of like the saturation of the market. But I guess in your experience now, these sound like these are also like pretty new and innovative things. Like how do you, like how has it changed?
Well, you're right. I think during the Dippin' Dots expansion, you know, it was a novel product. I mean, there was no other beaded products out there. So we definitely had kind of a neat thing going on there. The good news is, I guess, for the product now, the products that we're developing now, we never really tried to go head to head with Dippin' Dots. We were trying to, I was even thinking a lot of these things back when I owned Dippin' Dots. I wanted to have products that were complementary to Dippin' Dots because Dippin' Dots is kids, you know, for the most part, mm-hmm. kids of all ages, but kids.
Right. But eventually those kids end up getting older and becoming adults.
So that's who we were going to, you know, that's who we were really thinking about, like with 40 Below Joe, you know, it's beads of coffee that you eat, you know, and it's got non-dairy creamer beads mixed with it.
So when you say coffee, is it coffee flavored or is it actual caffeinated like coffee?
No, it's actually caffeinated coffee. I actually developed my own espresso process. Mm-hmm. I actually don't have any moving parts in it. I use nitrogen pressure from the nitrogen tank and I push hot water through just like you would pump hot water through an espresso machine. So we have a very high quality coffee. When we first started, we were going to actually sell it as something you just brought back to life, you know, by adding water and steaming it or microwaving it. But then we found, well, why not just eat it? Because, you know, so that would be something different. A lot of the products, like I said, are going to be, I think, fill-in products that could go after the person that grew up on Dippin' Dots.
Yeah.
So now you can get your protein by eating a bead, you know, for example.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things I was reading was that a lot of the product, or Dippin' Dots, especially at the time, couldn't be carried in a lot of grocery stores, mainly because of the fact that they didn't carry the 40 Below equipment or refrigeration, freezer, or whatever you want to call it.
Right.
How did you guys go about solving that problem either back then or now, or is it still an unsolved and perhaps more of an opportunity, I would say, than a challenge?
Yeah, well, I think we turned it into more of a, knowing that we had to have a 40 below freezer, we continued to work on different, you know, types of freezers that right. we can maybe buy a little bit less expensive than we first started. But also, we've turned them into little billboards. So probably back in the late 2000s, I guess, you know, we started putting, you used to only get Dippin' Dots like in theme parks and ball stadiums and all that.
Dodger Stadium.
Yeah, exactly. So
get your hot dog and your Dippin' Dots.
So we started putting like these little freezers into, you know, grocery stores, right. convenience stores. And, but they actually are their own little billboards too. So, you know, even though it's a little bit of an expense, you get some specialized advertising. So it, that actually, has been a real growth piece of Dippin' Dots over the last few years is once we put those in there, you know, it's a way mm-hmm. for the franchisees can put, they can run their fairs and festivals right. and things, but they can also have their own little distribution routes and right. things like that.
Knowing what you know and what you've experienced, for someone who's just maybe getting into or coming of age to be, you know, someone who maybe wants to like start a business or let's say they're graduating high school or college, it could be anything, I guess. What advice would you have for them, or something that you've learned, like a really key piece or lesson that you've learned that you can share?
Well, I think the advice that I usually give is, first of all, if you're creating something from scratch, you need to understand that it's not that easy. In other words, you really want to make sure that you've got an idea that you really believe in. So I think you have to have a real passion for what you're doing, and you have to really believe in it. But I also say, you know, give yourself a few days or a week and ask yourself then, is it as good of an idea as when I thought of it? You know, because you really have to be sold that you think you can really make a business. And then really it's all about, at that point, it's really all about persistence. I mean, it's literally like once you make that decision that this is, you know, this is what I'm going to do. It's like if I'm drowning in the river, you have to make a decision. Am I going to fight for my life? You know, and that's kind of the way it is when you start a business. It's because you're going to get every challenge thrown at you that you can think of, and then more that you can't think of. I used to say that I started a business at the perfect time because, like I said, I had $10,000 in savings and we sold a car for $4,000. And, you know, and I always thought, well, you know, at that time I was 28 years old and I had a couple degrees. I could probably go get a job if I lost it all. And that's kind of the approach, because if I'd had $100,000 in the bank, I would have been more careful.
Yeah.
But you know, once you're all in, it's like, you know, sports or anything else, you know, it's when you're backed into a corner and you really pull out all the stops to try and survive or win the game, you know, and that's kind of the way entrepreneurship is.
Well, Kurt, this has been an absolute pleasure, you know, chatting with you and learning your story. And we appreciate you being candid and sharing all these stories with us. And we're excited to see what happens next with 40 Below and what comes in the future. But thank you for the time.
All right. Thank you. Appreciate it.